Did you know that a guy from Tala is the Gordon Ramsay of Australia? And he is, and he's on the line now. Colin Fastenage, welcome to the show.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Good. Are you from Tala, yeah? That sounded Australian enough.
And then I lived there for 6 years, and then I moved to Castleknock. We made it big. My dad had a shoe shop in Blanchardstown, Tony Fastenage Footwear, very well known in Dublin. So I've been everywhere around Dublin.
Yeah, I can hear Dublin there now. The initial was a bit Australian. So listen, I believe your first episode as the kind of Gordon Ramsay character on Kitchen Nightmares Australia aired this week. How did it go?
Well, you'd be 100% wrong there, because the show is based on Kitchen Nightmares, but we when I got the job, because I've done My Kitchen Rules for 10 years, I said I didn't want to be the Gordon Ramsay, even though I've worked for Gordon Ramsay. The show rated really well. We've already signed season two after the first ep. But if you realise what Australia is at the minute, we've done it tough for the last 4 years. So everyone's had COVID around the world, but we had drought for 5 years. Then we had the fires. Then we had the floods. Then we had the longest lockdown in the world in COVID. So when I signed up to do Kitchen Nightmares, I said, I really do not want to be Gordon Ramsay. I want to be Colin Fastenage, because I've worked out 50 years trying to work out who I am. So our show shines a light on what's bad in the industry without demeaning people just for TV. So we've gone the opposite way, and the Australian public have loved it, because they don't want nasty TV. They want, like, obviously you've got to tell the truth, but they want TV with heart. And I think that's what we've given them. And it's gone very well.
Yeah, that sounds much more in tune with the times. Listen, half the country thinking of moving to Australia. I think they'll be a bit shocked after that litany of horrors you gave there. Is Australia slightly on the floor at the moment?
And, the last 5 years over here have been, it's been pretty full on, but it's a great country. Like, it is what it is, but we've done it tough. We've done it really tough. Mm. And it's down to the environment.
And have you bounced back from the pandemic well?
Yeah. I opened up in the city, Castlereagh Street. So we opened up a restaurant, Castlereagh by Fastenage, and that's foreign. But it's just one knock after another, like for 5 years. Like, obviously we've had the drought for years, and then, but the fires was huge. And as I said, the floods, we're in floods now because we're in the El Nino. But you like the city's cool. We're very, Aussies are like the Irish, very resilient, and they come back. We're doing all right at the minute.
Yeah, okay. So listen, for people in Ireland who mightn't be familiar with you, how did you end up becoming this massive TV star in Australia?
I worked for Kevin Thornton in Dublin for a long time. I went to Carl Brewer Street. Then I worked for Raymond Blanc for 2.5 years. I worked for Ramsay for a year. And then I came to Oz, and I made my name. I had a crappy pub that we don't have Michelin stars over here. We got hats. So we got three hats as opposed to stars.
That's so Australian. We don't have stars, mate. We got two hats.
Yeah. I got two stars in a pub. And we made our name from there. And then I maybe have been known for voicing my opinions.
Okay. Going back a little bit on the career progression there, Raymond Blanc, he's supposed to be a tough man to work for, is he?
There was 40. I went there as a kid, well, a 20-year-old kid. There was 40 chefs in the kitchen. It was 16 hours a day. You got paid very little, which is all illegal now. And but I learned to cook there. It was a very hard time. Would I do it again? I wouldn't rush into it, but it was, I learned my craft there.
Tell me the shaving story.
Oh, yeah, you've done your research, haven't you? So if you were late working in this kitchen where they had 40 chefs, so they'd buy in the pigs, and they used to have a big razor that they'd shave the pigs. Like to get the hair off before you cook them, whatever. So if you were late, they had this one big razor that the chef who was late would have to. And if you didn't shave because you were late, you'd have to shave your face. So can you imagine a Bic razor that's a year old and have to shave your face in the kitchen in front of everyone. Like, it wasn't pretty.
You see, we're learning a lot more now, aren't we, Colin, about the kind of, I don't know, would you call it abuse or virtual kind of slavery that goes into, like, for example, the high-end tasting menus and the work that needs to go into that. And there was kind of a Me Too, I think, around the Copenhagen fine dining scene. Are you now realising that it's wrong to treat people like this?
Oh, look, when I worked there, I've seen some of the worst things ever that worked in Michelin star kitchens. But the thing was, I could have left, but we were afraid of ruining our CV at the time, because there was no internet, there was no Instagram, there was no whatever. So your CV was your ticket around the world. But now over here, like, Australia was like that for a little bit, but it's all changed. And now my daughters could go into that industry and I'd be quite happy. But 10 years ago, I would not let my daughters go into that industry. And it's 100%. It was a Me Too. I've seen some shocking things go on in that industry.
Like what?
What was that?
Like what?
I've seen a girl in La Mamo have a breakdown mid service, and like a full on breakdown, and people just stood over her. Or did she got put in the fridge actually to calm down? I see a guy get knocked out mid service. He was on the larder in Le Manoir. He got fully knocked out and people just stood over him and kept going service. It was because you were run by a tyrant, not Blanc, but there was his head chef. But it was, I've seen stuff that I look back at now and go, oh my God.
And come here, you know, the way I think this situation that happened in Copenhagen was that one restaurant had this culture, but then all the alumni from that restaurant went out and opened their own places and kind of perpetuated the culture. When you had your own kitchen then, did you try and be more enlightened, or did you find that you kind of perpetuated the system a little bit?
No, I was exactly the same. I ruled by the same iron fist and for a few years. And then when no one would work for you, like I reached the pinnacle in Australia. I was known for being the hard Irish chef, and I had all the awards. We were killing it. And then when I had my first daughter, I was like, you know, there's more to life than this. And I changed my ways pretty earlier on. And I actually did better once I changed my ways. But it was when I had my first daughter, Lily. I think you, for a little while, you continue on. Of course you do. You've got this syndrome where you leave these kitchens and you carry on. But then not everyone changes, but we did. And it like, big ups to my wife, Jane Holland, who runs all our restaurants. She was front of house, and they're sort of the people who ground you and keep you normal.
Yeah. When you say all our restaurants, what's your stable now at the moment?
I've got a pub. And I've got a restaurant in the city, which is quite all right at the minute, because the way the economy is at the minute over here with interest rates and everything, you don't want to be expanding too much.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, so then when did you start doing TV? My Kitchen Rules, you say you've been doing for 10 years, yeah? How did that kind of come about?
Well, obviously, as you said, I was known as the angry Irish guy, so they wanted someone... who was opinionated and wasn't Aussie all happy. And so they brought me in, and I was quite opinionated. Actually, I was getting fired on the first step. I thought it was great. But when you go on TV, it's actually a very different skill to learn. And I went on and I wasn't really concentrating. They were like, well, if you're not being you, we're going to get rid of you. So then I sort of played the whole Simon Cowell thing for a few years. And then I realized, actually, that's not me. There's more to me than that. So I changed sort of the way I was viewed on TV, and people sort of liked the nicer version, which is actually me. So 10 years in MKR, which was good. And then I actually did a show in Ireland called Colin's Ireland, where we went back, and that was a big hit over here. A lot of Aussies watched that, and now we're on Kitchen Nightmares.
So are you kind of more of a television personality than a chef now at this stage?
I would say I am I keep my feet in both camps, because if you buy into the television world, you're an idiot, because I trust no one in television land, and they will drop you in a heartbeat. I've been fired by television many times and been back. So I'm a restaurateur more than a chef now. Like I was cleaning toilets last week, fixing light fittings, doing flower arrangements in the restaurants. So I'm very aware of never trust TV land. Like if you buy into that land, I'm quite lucky I got into TV as older in age rather than younger. So I don't believe everything they say. So I'm in both camps.
Yeah, yeah. No, but listen, people mightn't have a kind of an understanding of your level of kind of fame / notoriety out there. You were on I'm a Celebrity in Australia.
Yeah, I got to the final, actually.
Did you? Yeah.
Oh, look, I've always watched that show. It was on a different channel. So when I got fired by Channel 7 because I said something wrong, I went to Channel 10 and they offered me... I'm a Celebrity, and I've always watched that show with my kids and said I would love to do that. And then I got the chance to do it. And it was in pandemic, and obviously you get paid for it. So there wasn't a lot of work going at the minute. So I went into the jungle and I had a ball. I loved it.
So do they go into the same jungle that people go into over here when they go to Australia to do the show? That's actually the home of it, presumably, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the Ant and Dec people, normally over here they go to South Africa, but because of the pandemic, they use the English version of it, which is, it's in Queensland, but it's in the jungle. So it's actually the same snakes, same crocodiles, everything.
And you've done cookbooks as well?
Two cookbooks. I did one a long time ago when we had our restaurant, which was very chefy, and it was called Four Kitchens, and yeah, it was chefy, and not a lot of people would get a lot of use out of that one. And then last year I released one called The Common Sense Cook, which is just basically all the meals I ate with my family.
There you go.
And yeah, and that's been a great seller.
Okay, so will you do more?
I only do cookbooks when it means something. Like I don't want to push them out just to... It sounds a bit... whatever. I know people who push out 5 books a year or whatever, and they don't even write them. So for me, it takes 2 years to write a book, and I'm not interested. I'm busy at the minute, so if I do, it'll be another 2 years, because you've got to write it yourself, and the recipes have got to be from you. And if you're just pushing them out just to get cash, it's not really worth it.
Do the chefs really test all those recipes and everything? Or they're not flunkies doing it all?
No,
and then they...
100%. I'm telling you now, 100% no. I know chefs who have teams who Google recipes and they'll push out 5 books a year.
Yeah, yeah. So you're in business with your wife. How does that work?
Well, she's the boss on the face. And no, it works very well, because like sometimes in TV land, you might think you be all and end all, and then you come home, they'll tell you you're not. And she's very good at what she does. And she's front of house, so chefs have got egos and like to think that everything revolves around them and it's all about the food, but it's not really, because it's the hospitality side of things. The front of house actually saves the chefs a lot. So I think chefs forget that the front of house actually is a big part of a restaurant and can actually save the chefs from, you know, when we do something wrong.
Yeah, because they are the contact and they are the experience that the public have when they're in there, I suppose, aren't they?
Well, 100%. Like, not chefs think that nothing goes wrong, but like stuff goes wrong all the time. And if you've got a good front of house, they can solve a problem there and then, rather than let someone leave the building and tell like 100 people how bad the experience was. They can fix it.
Yeah, the TripAdvisor must be a murder for you guys, is it? Because you get one unhappy punter and suddenly it blows up.
I couldn't be bothered with TripAdvisor. We've look, once you go on the sort of the TV side of things, you've got a target in your back anyway. So you've sort of got to have a thick skin when it comes to when you have restaurants and you're on TV as well, because you're it's an open market.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, 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 and you've had a bit of grief as well because of the Celebrity, haven't you? You like kind of, I suppose, more than trolling a bit, wasn't it? Kind of threats and stuff at your family?
Oh, in the, yeah. Well, in the early days, when you go on television and you're on a hit TV show and you're a chef and no one tells you what TV's like, so that's the problem. Not, like, TV producers don't tell you, like, oh, once the show finishes, it's open market on you. I'd stuff said about my kids, about my wife, molest my kids, whatever. So I went to the police, and then the cops were like, well, there's nothing really we can do. And I said, are you sure? Because at the time my daughters were 2 and 3 and someone said they'll babysit my kids. And he said, so what do you reckon? I said, well, if I find a guy who said he's going to babysit my kids, they're going to bury him in the forest. And the guy goes, did you just say you're going to kill someone? I said, well, mate, my daughters are 2 and 3. And if someone said there's not a parent in the land would say anything about that. And he said, well, you know, you can be arrested for that. And I was like, well, on you go.
Yeah, only in Australia.
Social media laws really hadn't caught up with what was happening at the time. People could, like on Twitter, have an egg or a number 234. You could say whatever they want about your kids, or your family or whatever. And you just had to take it.
Yeah. It must be nice for you when you're home in Ireland. So, and people don't kind of really know who you are mostly, do they?
You think that I was home in July. I rented a farmhouse in Kerry, actually. It's beautiful. I actually watched Dublin play Kerry in a pub, me and 4 Kerry guys, and we lost. But anyway,
yeah.
I was the only, but it was great. But yeah, lots of people knew who I was, which was quite surprised, because MKR thinks on like 2 channels or something over there, and but it's nice to have Irish people, like the Irish. Are very proud, I think, of Irish people who go abroad and do good for them, which I'm quite proud of, sort of shining the flag for Ireland, because I've met a lot of Irish people over here who are like you're making a great name for Ireland, and they're so proud of you, which is I didn't realise in the early days of TV. Now I do. So you're sort of carrying the Irish flag for you.
Yeah, that's fantastic though, isn't it? Yeah. So you'll never come back here now, will you? Australia's home for good, is it?
Well, I've got too many bills over here. I've got a mortgage. No, my kids are Aussies. And I came here in 1999. And, you know, I've worked so hard to get to where we are. Well, we've worked so hard to get where we are. And, like, if I went back to Ireland, I'd be just starting from scratch again. But it's not saying you're on top of the world over here, but you're still working away. But this is my home now.
Yeah. Listen, I believe you were feeding Irish immigrants during the lockdowns.
I was, yeah. I met actually a few people from Tala. Oh, when it was pretty bad actually, because when COVID hit, we got job. It was called JobKeeper. I'm not sure what it was called over there. So anyone who was a citizen got JobKeeper, but all like the chefs and the local or people who didn't have visas, the government basically dropped them and said you've got to leave the country. So there was a lot of Irish workers, families, and Aussie families, and Indians and whoever, Nepalese, huge. So I started a soup kitchen from the car park of my pub. I was actually locked out of the pub because the landlord closed the building, because it's cheaper to.
Colin?
But people gave me food, and I fed everyone for a year from a car park.
Okay, listen, it's fantastic to hear an Irish success story out there in Australia, and I'm sure there are loads more of them. But that's Colin Fastenage, chef and star of Kitchen Nightmares Australia. Thank you very much, Colin. Great to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, see you, Colin. We'll take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.